Okay, what you're going to hear this morning is something that's not in the book, because there wasn't room for it. It's a chapter called Trauma, Synchronicity, and Paranormal Experience in Analysis. Maybe this will appear in print sometime, maybe it won't. Trauma, Synchronicity, and Paranormal Experiences in Analysis. Let's start with a poem. This is Rilke, called No One Lives His Life. Disguised since childhood, haphazardly assembled from voices and fears and little pleasures, we come of age as masks. Our true face never speaks. And yet, though we strain against the deadening grip of daily necessity, I sense there is this mystery. All life is being lived. Who is living it then? Is it the things themselves or something waiting inside them, like an unplayed melody in a flute? Is it the winds blowing over the waters? Is it the branches that signal to each other? Is it flowers interweaving their fragrances? Or streets as they wind through time? Is it the animals warmly moving, or the birds that suddenly rise up? Who lives it then? God, are you the one who is living life? No one lives his life. I can get you the reference. Let me see. Rilke's Book of Hours, Love Poems to God, 2005. Now, in this beautiful poem, the two worlds that have informed our discussions this weekend return again as, quote, our disguised or masked self, on the one hand, haphazardly assembled and straining against the deadening grip of daily necessity, and on the other hand, an underlying mystery, like the unplayed melody in a flute. This implicit, sometimes inaudible world proves to be the source of our true life, of our soul's life, something waiting inside us to be heard and seen and appreciated for what it is. The God who supports us in being and is the source of our aliveness, living our life, flowing through our life. I think in our work as psychotherapists, we really must keep this in mind at all times. When I sit with a person, and believe me, I've had some very unlikable people in treatment with me, I'm always looking for what it is inside them, the unplayed melody in their flute. Because once I get to it, I love them. The reason I don't like them is that I'm dealing with their defenses. You know, their constructed self, their interpreted self. So when they break through to their true life, which often includes their true pain and then their true joy, there's nothing more lovable than that. So I'm always trying to make contact with that, you know. I always ask myself, where is the likable person in this monster? Now, mind you, I'm not saying everybody's a monster, but sometimes the defenses are so strong that we have trouble reaching to that true self underneath. So this morning, I want to relate a series of strange and fascinating stories of encounters that psychoanalysts, including Jung, have had with anomalous phenomena. That's the general term. These encounters give hints or intimations of a second world, suggesting something akin to Rilke's underlying spiritual mystery. They defy explanation by the normal physical laws that organize our sense of reality. And so they open to a realm of non-ordinary reality, lying beyond the material and rational world that we think we understand. They provide us with some admittedly speculative but provocative evidence for the two worlds that we've been discussing. Experiences like this are called extrasensory or paranormal. They're known in the parapsychological community as PSI, P-S-I. The vignettes I'm going to relate in a moment are anecdotal, and so they don't lend themselves to scientific, controlled scientific study. They cannot be objectively proven, although J.B. Rhine and the people at Duke University have done a pretty good job of showing that statistically these phenomena are real. They're remarkable and fascinating and bring a sense of greater meaning subjectively into the lives of those who have been graced by their occurrence. They bring intimations of something more in this life, links to the world and to others that seem to transcend what we would expect from the usual way in which people and things are connected. These experiences, paranormal experiences, have intrigued psychoanalysts since the very beginning of our profession, but they are rarely reported. All the early pioneers of depth psychology had a keen interest in anomalous phenomena and took them seriously as worthy of investigation. Freud was especially interested in mental telepathy, which he called thought transference. Although Freud was loath to compromise the scientific foundations of analysis by letting in what he called the black tide of occultism, the black tide of mud, occultism, both Jung and Ferenczi were far more interested in the scientific exploration of paranormal experiences. Freud tried his best to restrain both Jung and Ferenczi from going public with their findings. Finally, in 1911, he capitulated. In a letter to Ferenczi, who he called the uncanny one, Freud said, quote, Jung writes that we must also conquer occultism and request permission to undertake a campaign in the realm of mysticism. I see that both of you cannot be restrained any longer. You should at least proceed in harmony with each other. These are dangerous expeditions, and I can't go along there. Regards to you, uncanny one. Ferenczi had become convinced that cases of thought transference and analysis were extraordinarily frequent, and he proposed that psychic phenomena might be involved in what he called the dialogue of unconsciouses that takes place between analyst and patient when they meet on a deep level. Jung was also fascinated by the paranormal, and over the course of his life, experienced many uncanny moments that defied rational explanation. His interest in explaining these phenomena was in full flower way back in his student days at the Zofingius fraternity, where he gave several lectures to his fellow students. In one of these, he cited the well-authenticated report by Emanuel Swedenborg, who had a famous vision. Swedenborg had disrupted a garden party in Gothenburg, Sweden, in 1756, by suddenly announcing the Great Fire in Stockholm, 200 miles away. While staring at a clear evening sky, he had described the firestorm vividly in every detail, including the advance of the fire to within three buildings of his own house, before it was finally extinguished. 2 days later, a messenger from Stockholm arrived, confirming every detail of his description. How, Jung wondered, could a man standing in one place visualize an event that happened 200 miles away at exactly the same moment? Any notion of the normal transmission of information across space seemed to be irrelevant in this example. In some of Jung's other uncanny experiences, it was not space but time that appeared to be relativized. Jung reported the following example from his student days. Quote, I remember the story of a student friend whose father had promised him a trip to Spain if he passed his final exams satisfactorily. My friend thereupon dreamed that he was walking through a Spanish city. The street led to a square where there was a Gothic cathedral. He then turned right around a corner in his dream to another street. Then he was met by an elegant carriage drawn by two cream-colored horses. Then he woke up from the dream. He told us all about this dream as we were sitting around a table drinking beer. Shortly afterward, having successfully passed his exams, he went to Spain And there, in one of the streets, he recognized the city of his dream. He found the square and the cathedral, which exactly corresponded to the dream image. He wanted to go straight to the cathedral, but then he remembered that in the dream he had turned right at the corner into another street. He was curious to find out whether his dream would be corroborated any further. Hardly had he turned the corner when suddenly he saw, in reality, the carriage with the two large cream-colored horses passing by. How to explain this event? The man's dream seems to have anticipated the actual event as though there were a kind of foreknowledge in the unconscious. Or perhaps time and space didn't exist in the unconscious, Jung thought. Later, while practicing as a psychiatrist, Jung had a significant paranormal experience. And I told you briefly about this, and I'll read it in his language because it's vivid. He cites the case of this woman patient who, despite all his efforts, proved to be very psychologically inaccessible. She protected herself with a highly rational, intellectualized defense, which made any kind of deep analytic work impossible. And Jung says, quote, "I had to confine myself to the hope that something unexpected and irrational would turn up, something that would burst the intellectual retort into which she had sealed herself." Well, I was sitting opposite her one day with my back to the window, listening to her flow of rhetoric. She had had an impressive dream the night before in which someone had given her a golden scarab, a costly piece of jewelry. While she was still telling me this dream, I heard something behind me gently tapping on the window. I turned around and saw that it was a large flying insect that was knocking against the window pane from outside in the obvious effort to get into the darkened room. This seemed very strange to me. I opened the window immediately and caught the insect in the air as it flew in. It was a scarabeed beetle, whose golden-green color most nearly resembles that of the golden scarab. I handed the beetle to my patient with the word, "Here is your scarab." This broke the ice of her intellectual resistance. The treatment could now be continued with satisfactory results. This, of course, is a typical story that psychoanalysts tell about how the whole treatment cleared up with one in one moment, you know. There's a great story like that where Jung was consulted by a colleague at a conference who said he had a very difficult patient who he couldn't reach, and the patient was very resistant, and he just didn't know what to do with her, and he asked Jung if he would accept a referral, and Jung said, okay, I'll see her for an hour, and so the hour was arranged, and the woman came in, and she was indeed very out of touch, and Jung, as was his wont, was looking out the window into the lake, Zurichsee there, and he found himself singing a lullaby to her. A lullaby that he had heard from his mother about the boats on the lake. And a year later, he ran into that colleague again at a conference. And the colleague said, "Dr. Jung, what have you done with my patient? Great insight that you had. It must have been amazing results." Jung said, "I sang her a lullaby." Now, isn't that a wonderful story? I mean, it's a wonderful story about Jung and the kinds of thing that can be healing in therapy. Jung was instinctively aware that this woman desperately needed something underneath the linear left brain languaged conversation. She needed to hear something that she probably hadn't ever heard for many, many years, which was a lullaby. So anyway, but that again was a story about, you know, one moment and person is cured. It doesn't tend to work that way. Anyway, in this event of the scarab, there were simultaneous inner and outer events, the woman's dream on the one hand and the outer appearance of the beetle, inner and outer, two worlds, that seemed to be meaningfully linked, but not in a way that one could have caused the other. So in these examples of spooky connections, the parameters of space, time, and causality seem to be strangely suspended. As a possible way of explaining these events and others like them, Jung began to wonder about what Leibniz had previously described as a pre-existing harmony between an internal state of mind or psyche and the outer cosmic field of energy and matter. Could it be, he wondered, that mind and matter are unified by this underlying harmony, a kind of unifying third which transcends the unsolvable dilemmas of space-time, body-mind, cause-effect, and unites these dualities in a higher or deeper trans-rational order, an implicate order, as David Bohm would say. Eventually, in 1951 and 1955, which was very late in his life, this is precisely what Jung suggested in his essay on synchronicity. He offered the idea of synchronicity to provide a model for understanding such events. By the term, he meant the coincidence of two events, one an inner experience, a dream, an image, a thought, a feeling, or intuitive perception, with an outer event, like the fire in Stockholm or the beetle at the window, where the coincidence of these two events is meaningful, obviously, but where a causal connection between the two is out of the question. Inner and outer, psyche and physis, psyche in the physical world, are therefore linked not by causality operating in the space-time continuum, but by meaning, which transcends it. So synchronicity is an a-causal connecting principle based on meaningful coincidence. That's his definition. A-causal connecting principle based on meaningful coincidence. By proposing that psyche and matter might be two different aspects of one and the same thing, Jung was left to wonder what this irrepresentable transcendental something might be. Here he took some solace from modern quantum physics, which also has no name for the essential noumenal nature of light, for example, which also can appear phenomenally in either of two paradoxical forms, particle and wave. Near the end of his life, in a letter to Carl Schmitt, Jung says, "Naturally, we can postulate there is something hidden behind these phenomena, the matter and psyche. But this gets no further, since it is impossible for us to conceive what that something would be. I've just read that modern physics have coined a name for it. It's a terrifying expression, universion, which is at the same time cosmon and anti-cosmon. Such extravaganzas get us nowhere. This is where mythology begins." Jung noticed one additional important psychological factor that seemed to accompany synchronous events: heightened emotionality in the subject. This observation was supported by the experimental results of J.B. Rhein, who found that his positive results in ESP experiments fell off as soon as his subjects lost interest in the procedure. The fact that heightened affect seemed to be a necessary psychic condition to produce synchronous events suggested to Jung the presence of an activated archetype. Quote, the effective numinous agents in the unconscious are the archetypes. By far the greatest number of spontaneous synchronistic phenomena, said Jung, that I've had occasion to observe and analyze can easily be shown to have a direct connection with an activated archetype. This in itself is an irrepresentable psychoid factor of the collective unconscious. Psychoid. So synchronicity was his explanation, and then he proposed this archetypal collective layer, psychoid layer, which seemed to unify psyche and physics, matter and spirit. Roger Maines says, "This postulated unitary background to existence in which the concepts of psyche and matter and space and time merge into a psychophysical space-time continuum was where Jung considered the archetypes themselves as opposed to their phenomenal manifestations." In other words, the archetypes themselves were located in this superordinate unitary background.